And so it is time now for our first invited guest, and it's a pleasure for me to introduce Simon John. Simon was a graduate student co-supervised by Charles and myself, but he was actually my first PhD student, one of two students who got their PhD at about the same time, 1991. He had arrived from Wales to start his PhD at McGill, and he worked on the molecular genetics of PKU. We all thought he had great potential at the time, but we were never quite sure because he had such a thick Welsh accent that we weren't quite sure what he was saying at the time. But eventually it became clear that he was destined for an outstanding career, and he left our group for much greener pastures. He pursued postdoctoral training with Oliver Smithies, a Nobel Prize winner at the University of North Carolina, studying genes that contributed to essential hypertension. Simon is now an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and a senior staff scientist at the Jackson Laboratory. He has received various awards for his research on glaucoma, including the 1997 and 1998 Ruth Salta Jr. Investigator Achievement Awards. He received the Kogan Award in 2004 from the Association for Research on Visual Science, and also in 2004, the Lewis Rudin Glaucoma Prize from the New York Academy of Medicine. In 2006, he received the Global Glaucoma Award from the Association of International Glaucoma Societies. He's going to talk about his insights on glaucoma using various mouse models. Does someone walk away with the pointer? You've got your own? Okay.
Thank you, Vima. Thank you. It's a great honor and very humbling to be talking to this audience today. I'd like to start by thanking everybody. My time at McGill was very formative for my career and very, very important. In addition to talking about exciting concepts that we think about every day in our work, flux, steady state, flow through pathways, individuality, lots of these concepts were ingrained in me here at McGill. And Charles and Rima were instrumental in my training. In addition to my interactions with Charles and Rima, I had many teachers, and what hasn't been mentioned so much yet today is the courses and the wonderful human genetics and biology courses which we had to take. I was never a great student on exams, but what I learned is still with me and is very, very important, and I try to pass on to my students. A couple of key concepts which I did learn is a phrase Charles used to use a lot about every individual being unique. I use this term in terms of disease, and this is something we think about every day in terms of thinking about the complexity of disease, how everybody manifests the disease in a different way, and how everybody responds very differently to the drugs and to the treatments, and we have to think about that as we move towards the era of personalized medicine. In taking that lesson with me and working in my laboratory, we think about this in terms of the complexity of diseases and biological systems. And the way we go about studying some of this complexity is by thinking about the effects of natural variants in the genetic background, and more recently, copy number variations. And copy number variations, where the number of copies of a particular gene in the genome can change, even differ between identical twins, we know now, which affects our estimates of heritability and many other features we've got to take into account. We have to think about modifier genes and environmental effects. I'm thinking about lessons from hyperphenylalanine anemias and other conditions I learned at McGill. I'm very proud that in our research we've identified, through learning biological mechanisms and molecular mechanisms of disease, we've actually been able to uncover some important environmental factors which appear to be important in human disease and could be helping to save lives or affect lives by lessening disability patients having diseases other than glaucomas. The other thing I'd like to thank Rima and Charles and the group for is they taught me tolerance and how to respect individuals. Personally, I had many deficits and raised many challenges, and they taught me how to really deal with individuals, be tolerant, and to supply a supportive and nurturing environment. And I don't think I'd be here today if it wasn't for this wonderful environment they presented. So let's get on to the research. As many of you are aware, the glaucomas are very common diseases. They may actually be some of the most common neurodegenerative diseases, affecting about 70 million people worldwide. Coming back to individuality and complexity and how many pathways and environmental factors impact disease, I'd say glaucomas are very, very classic, complex diseases, and they're a very heterogeneous group of diseases. The cardinal features and diagnostic features of a death of retinal ganglion cells, the output neurons of the retina that connect the eye to the brain. And because the axons of these cells course through the optic nerve also degenerates in these conditions. There are a variety of known risk factors, very important to this audience. Genetics and family history are very important, as is increase in age. And one of the key factors, which was once thought to be a diagnostic factor, but is now a very important risk factor, is a harmfully high intraocular pressure often contributes to these conditions. Some basic ocular anatomy to remind you. The eye, the fluid, is made by a structure known as the ciliary body, and this fluid or aqueous humor flows into the front of the eye, and it drains out in a circular drainage structure located in this region of the eye, right at the back of the cornea, the transparent part of the eye. Excuse me. In glaucoma, there's normally a very compromised drainage system, about 80% compromised, which leads to a high intraocular pressure. So to understand glaucomas as diseases, we have to study this drainage compromise. We're doing a lot of work in this area, which I'll hardly talk about today. The other area we have to think about in glaucoma is the neurons. It's the neurons that ultimately die. The retinal ganglion cells live in the retina, and you might have a retinal ganglion cell in the retina here, and it has a long axon which courses across the eye, this 2.5 millimeters, and then out through the optic nerve and back into the brain. This axon is traveling many millimeters, so it's a very long axon, and these are the only long projecting neurons in the retina. And that will become important to bear that in mind as I go through the rest of my talk. When you get the functional compromise, the high intraocular pressure becomes high, and then this somehow damages these axons and these cells, and they die, and they lead to a very characteristic pattern of optic nerve degeneration, which is reminiscent of glaucoma. In my lab, we use an experimental genetics approach. Largely, we use the mouse as a true experimental platform where we can change individual genes or map individual genes and then change them in directed ways to test hypotheses. And as we learn things in mice, we then try to work back to human genetics and the human population. But I'll just be talking about mouse work today. So in the lab, we tend to use inherited models so we can get at initiating causes to understand both the decreased drainage in the eye, which leads to high intraocular pressure, and how this high intraocular pressure then induces death of these retinal ganglion cells, or RGCs. We use the full array of modern genetic tools, from gene mapping calculus, so we get different types of genes and genes that modify the effects of other genes, and candidate genes, as you're well aware of, and we use mutants to test specific hypotheses or to gain specific knowledge. The model I'm going to focus on throughout the talk is the DBA2J model. This is a strain of mice that we uncovered develops an inherited glaucoma known as pigmentary glaucoma. In pigmentary glaucoma, you get a disease of the iris, and the iris cells break open. And this releases pigment from the heavily pigmented iris and debris into the eye, and this pigment and debris gets into the drainage structures of the eye. This leads to high intraocular pressure, and then ultimately leads to retinal ganglion cell death. Keeping in mind complexity and individuality, what I'm going to focus on in my rest of my talk is how we uncovered this linear phenotype and how we've been able to uncover mechanisms that are active in different tissues at different points in this disease. Charles used the term once, like unpeeling an onion. We think of this as unpeeling an onion layer by layer and getting at these levels of complexity. What we've shown, and what last time was at McGill I spoke about, so I'm going to go very quickly, is in fact this is a truly multifactorial disease. We now know there's about 10 genes important. The first two we identified actually modulate this iris disease. These two genes, tyrosine-related protein 1 and glycosylated protein NMB, have mutations in them. Both of these genes affect melanosomes, which make pigment in the eye. They disturb these melanosomes in a way that allows toxic intermediates of pigment production to leak out and damage the cell itself. They leak out from this contained compartment into the cell proper and cause problems. One of these genes, GPNB, and I want you to remember this name, it comes important later in the talk, also affects innate immunity. And this innate immunity amplifies the little bit of damage caused by the melanosome toxicity to propagate this iris disease. Following that, you get dispersed pigment, and the dispersed pigment goes into the drain of the eye. By putting these mutations into different mouse strains to have different genetic backgrounds, we found that this isn't a simple blockage. In some strains, you get all this dispersed pigment and debris going into the drain, causing a high intraocular pressure. In other strains, they get equal amounts of pigment and debris into the drain, but they never get a high intraocular pressure. And by looking at the differences between these strains, we're uncovering a local form of inflammation and some genes involved in this, where the dispersed pigment induces an active damaging reaction, which elevates the intraocular pressure. I'm going to go away from talking about pressure for the rest of the talk. The one other concept I want to leave you on this slide is traditionally we've thought about in this disease high intraocular pressure causing retinal ganglion cell death. I've been recommending we throw that concept out in the short term and talk about retinal ganglion cell stress. What our work and the work of other groups has shown is in the face of a high intraocular pressure, retinal ganglion cells can remodel and be in a stressed state, even in mice, for many months. And the cells change but are living during this period of time. And during this period of time, they're seeing a multitude of different stresses which are determining whether or not they survive or whether they die. And I'll mention that briefly as I go on. Now I'm going to focus just on the neurobiology of the disease and just on one of the areas we're studying in our lab, what pathways and molecules are involved and how are these retinal ganglion cell neurons insulted. This has been hardly known in glaucoma. There's been a lot of ideas, but very little experimental evidence. This is again from the DBA2J model. And similar to a human disease, this disease is very variable and asynchronous. If you look at an age profile of optic nerve damage, which increases in severity, say at any one age, there's a lot of heterogeneity. The other point I'd like to raise on this slide is genetically identical individuals don't necessarily get the disease at the same time in either. All of these mice are genetically identical. This shows a possibly copy number variation, local environmental effects, and chance effects also modify these diseases, and we have to bear those in mind also. One other stage I want to mention here is this NOAA early stage. Why would we call something NOAA early? Well, at the ages when we look at the mice, they get high intraocular pressures by about 6 months, and as they age out, they all see a high intraocular pressure. And what we reasoned was, in some of these eyes that have no morphological features of glaucoma, called NOAA early, they've had early molecular changes that we can't yet determine. And I'll come back to that later in my talk as well. So we called it NOAA early, because they will likely be a heterogeneous group. Some of which had seen enough intraocular pressure to change their biology, others which had not seen enough intraocular pressure, and truly didn't really have any molecular changes. I mentioned the GPNMB mutation, and I asked you to remember it. The reason I asked you to remember it is we showed that the mutation in this gene occurred in this mouse strain around 1983. So to control our experiments, we were able to go back to the freezer and pull out the 1983 mouse strain, which is heterozygous for this mutation, breed that mutation into the modern-day strain in many generations, and now we have a wonderful control strain, which is the same as other DBA2J mice, except for being wild-type for the GPNMB gene, and this wild-type strain does not develop this glaucoma. So behind all the experiments, I'll tell you this control is there, but I won't have time to tell you about the ways we used it, except in one experiment. So the first question I'll tell you about, which we addressed, was which pathways kill retinal ganglion cells? And actually, in the last decade, it's become very clear that the neuron is not just one cell you can think of as being uniform. It's a very polarized cell, and the cell body, or soma, the axon, and the synapse is actually discrete compartments within the cell. And it's actually becoming clear that in some diseases, the axon may undergo demise by one specific pathway, the cell body by a distinct pathway, and the synapses possibly by a distinct pathway again. This isn't well understood, but it's an important concept. So what did we find when we wanted to look at pathways? Richard Libby was one of my postdocs, who I've tried to impart some of the knowledge I learned at McGill to, and Joe Barto was a summer student, started working with us when he was 16 years old, and continued until he started graduate school at the age of 23 last year. So it's been a lot of fun interacting with students. The research Rick and Joe did was to look at this molecule BAX, BCL2-associated X protein. You probably know it as a key mediator of apoptosis or programmed cell death. Well, BAX can move to the mitochondria during stressful conditions and induce cell death. It is an excellent candidate for various reasons to contribute to glaucoma, So we bred this allele into DBA2J, another allele for many generations, so we essentially had two types of DBA2J mice, either mutant or wild type for this gene, and then we could ask the effects of Bax. Well, what did we find? These are cross-sections of optic nerves from the mouse. In these young mice, you see these beautifully normal little circular structures known as axons. The axons are the retinal ganglion cells which connect this nerve to the brain. If you look at Bax mutant mice, which cannot make any Bax, they get a very severe glaucoma where none of these axons remain, indistinguishable from these wild-type mice. Therefore, Bax is not required for the demise or degeneration of the axons of these retinal ganglion cells. Remember that, because the opposite is true for the cell bodies of those very same neurons. So here you see it. Here you see a retina and corresponding optic nerve. In the Bax mutant, or the wild-type animal. In the wild-type animal, this is the retinal ganglion cell. You see there's lots of cells died, and the axons are missing in the optic nerve. In the Bax homozygous mutant, however, all of these cell bodies survive, despite the complete loss of axons. This is a surprise, but an important result, because it shows that we've uncoupled the demise of the axon from the demise of the cell body. This was important in glaucoma because one of the theories of glaucoma suggested the axon shriveled away as a result of the death of the cell body. Obviously, that's not the case. If you quantify this carefully, actually 100% of the cells survive in the Bax mutants. And thinking about human disease and quantitative differences, even heterozygotes are very highly protected. So now when we think about the disease, glaucoma, many people have been trying to use anti-apoptotic therapies to keep these cells alive. What this work shows is using anti-apoptotic agents may keep the cell body alive, but it's going to be no use to vision, because those axons are likely to still degenerate. So we have to think about targeting both the soma and the axon as we think about treatments. Now I'm going to bring you to another question. Where is this neuron insulted? Does pressure affect the cell body, the axon, the synapses? Can we tell which goes first? Can we start to stage this? It's very early days in this research, but I'll show you where we've got so far. Some published data actually supports insults to the cell body for various groups. We haven't found much evidence of the key school of thought that says they are excitotoxic mechanisms. Another school in the field has suggested direct insults to this axon. Well, we've actually now have quite strong evidence suggesting this indeed is true, and I'll go through that evidence with you. So now, automaton tissues, we're thinking about the optic nerve where these axons of the ganglion cells course through the wall of the eye to go towards the brain. The wall of the eye is broken, you can't have a solid wall on the axon, and there's a structure here known as a lamina fibrosa, which is a series of collagenous plates in a human. So let me show you that in more detail. This is from some of Doug Anderson's work on a schematic of this optic nerve head region of the eye. These are the nerve fibrillary where the axons of retinal ganglion cells come off the retina and into the optic nerve. These blue lines represent these collagenous plates of a structure known as the lamina fibrosa. In this lamina fibrosa, if you cut through one of these plates, the collagen is in blue, you'll see this pores. The pores are lined by astrocytes in red, and these little dots are the axons going through these pores as they exit the eye. Now, it's been suggested, the mechanical theory of glaucoma, the pressure pushes on these plates, causes them to bow backwards, and they actually pinch axons and blood vessels and cause very local damage. It's a very nice idea, but experimental proof has been lacking for this idea. And actually, in most glaucoma cases, the pressure is only a millimeter, two, three, 4 millimeters higher than that in any other person, which seems unlikely to be enough to distort these substantial extracellular limited plates and cause this damage for the majority of cases. So we were healthfully skeptical and we wanted to look at this in more detail. This is a digestion cast from a human optic nerve head. So this is a thick piece of tissue where all the soft tissue has been digested away, and these are the collagenous plates you're left with. Remember that in vivo, these plates are covered by astrocytes or glial cells that support neurons, and these pores are lined by astrocytes through an intimate association with the axons as they pass through them. Now let's look at what happens in the mouse, because the mouse has been claimed to be very different to a human. Well, when we looked at mice, they do indeed have a lamina region, despite some claims, and this is a GFAP stain for that region I showed you of the human optic nerve, but this is a mouse, and you see this clear structure where you've got all these glial cells or astrocytes. If you look at a 1 micron section through this region, it looks remarkably like the human lamina fibrosa, if you consider this is 1 micron and this is a thick digestion. Now, there is a species difference though, which is very important. And the species differences, these collagenous plates are completely missing. This is a trichome stain and collagen is in blue. If we look at the same level of section, we don't see this nice structure. It's completely missing in a mouse. So in a mouse, we don't have a lamina fibrosa with these collagenous plates that have been suggested to be essential to give you glaucoma, but we do have what we now call a glial lamina composed of astrocytes. Now, being as mice don't have these collagenous plates, it was still possible there could be an early insult in this part of the eye. So we wanted to look at that. So we've looked at this in different ways, and I'll just show you one of the methodologies. One of the ways we did it was we fed in a cyan fluorescent protein, a protein that glows cyan, into these mice, and we'd expressed this in retinal ganglion cells in the eye. You can't see clearly in this light, but this would be the eye. The nerve fiber layer with its axons of retinal ganglion cells run in the eye. It comes out through the optic nerve and the lamina, and then comes into the retroorbital optic nerve, and you tract the optic nerve through the chiasm and up the optic tract to its synapses in the superior colliculus. This is expressed in a lot of other tissues in the brain as well, but in the eye, it is clean. Why did we breed this gene into these mice? Well, it allowed us to assess the entire visual pathway from the cell body all the way to the terminal synapses in the brain. And we took a risk. It was well known that when you get sites of axon injury, focal axon injury, axonal contents accumulate at the sites of injury. So the risk we took was that maybe these fluorescent proteins would accumulate at sites of injury and you'd get hyperfluorescent areas you could pick out and then use other techniques to show if they were truly injured. Well, it worked wonderfully well. We were lucky. If we take a mouse optic nerve, and this is confocal sections through a flat-mounted piece of tissue, we can look in the eye in the nerve fiber layer, in the region just in front of this glial lamina, or in the glial lamina. And we also studied the entire visual system, but regarding from the cell body to the lamina, the first and only place we first saw these hyperfluorescent small regions of damage was in the lamina. We never saw them on the ocular side of this. If you look at these, they're beautifully discrete structures, actually very surprisingly discrete. Here's a 20 micron scale. Look at this axon here. The axon is coming along. It suddenly gets a little bit thicker and hyperfluorescent and then continues. Another example here. So these are very, very discrete and focal areas of initial axon injury, or at least morphologically I can say it's an initial axon injury. So these occurred in this lamina region where these glial cells were. We did other extensive studies to look at this, including by electron microscopy, and they all agreed. So what we'd uncovered in these eyes is that the first visible damage to these neurons occurred in that lamina region of the eye. Now, that does not mean that is where the insult occurs. It's well known in neurobiology and makes a lot of sense that you can stress one part of a cell, and that isn't the part that falls apart first, it's the part that may require the most resources to maintain. And if you don't have enough metabolic resources in the cells, you've damaged it over here. It might be a piece all the way over here that falls apart. And this has been demonstrated for motor neurons in different conditions. So identifying the first location of damage did not identify a site of insult. And being slow, it took me about 2 years to think up the correct experiment to do to find the site of insult, even though it was staring us in the face for a long time. So how did we go about identifying a site of insult? Well, we took a lesson from the peripheral nervous system, and we tried to reapply that. Observations in the peripheral nervous system showed if you focally traumatize an axon by cutting it or crushing it or applying a toxic drug, the distal part of the axon, defined as the part which is separated from the cell body by this lesion, rapidly degenerates by process of Willebrand degeneration within 1 or 2 days. So this distal axon degenerates very rapidly. But the proximal part of the axon, which remains attached to the cell body, was known to survive for about as long as that cell body survives. It just dies back a little bit. So we reasoned that if you move your site of insult, if this is a retinal ganglion cell, further out, and you could keep the cell alive, then the proximal axon might survive up to the point of that insult. And therefore, the extent of survival of the proximal axon would be showing you where the insult occurs. So we could do this experiment because I told you we'd used the box mutation, and the box mutants kept 100% of the retinal ganglion cells alive. So then we could ask, where does the proximal axon extend to in the box mutants? So if you think about this experiment, the optic nerve itself is distal to the eye, and it's likely to be distal to any insult induced by high intraocular pressure. This laminar region in the wall of the eye would be where the insult would be likely occurring if we were correct. Because in the box mutants, the cell bodies all survive that are sitting in the retina, if the insult truly occurs in the lamina, the proximal axon will course across the retina and come up to this laminar region. But it won't extend beyond that laminar region. Well, when we looked at the mutants, indeed, this is exactly what happens. Here's the data. This is a pre-glaucoma to psi neurofilaments or axons are stained in green. The cell bodies are in blue. Here's a severe glaucoma. We count in the axons behind the eye. None were remaining in a wild-type animal. All of the axons are gone. There's no green staining. In a box homozygous mutant, which is equally severe behind the eye, all of the distal axons are degenerate. It's remarkable. The proximal axons survive right up to this anterior edge of the lamina. The same result using different techniques, so this is now very strong experimental evidence that an insult actually occurs at this region of the eye within the lamina. We wanted to also look at functional tests, and if the axon is very important in glaucoma, if we can give a neuroprotective treatment which saves the axon, can we save the cell bodies and can we save any of their function? So we used a mutation known as Wallerian degeneration slow. This is a spontaneous mutation which creates an abnormal fusion gene with these various components. It's not known how this fusion gene functions, but what is known is if you cut or crush an axon, instead of the distal axon degenerating within 24 to 48 hours, they can survive for weeks and still conduct action potentials. So this is a treatment which protects axons. When we looked at the effects of this in the glaucoma, we got quite a strong result, considering the complexity of this disease. I'll focus you on the 12-month data here, because it's the easiest to understand. We didn't completely stop glaucoma in all eyes. Some still got severe glaucoma. But what is important, you're looking at different eyes, the number of eyes with no detectable glaucoma in this no early stage is more than 2.5 times larger. So we had a very profound effect in stopping the disease in many, many eyes by this one treatment. What's even more important is if we look over your function. The pattern electroretinogram is a measure of retinal ganglion cell activity. It's its electrical measure. In our control mouse, which I told you doesn't develop the glaucoma with that one-point mutation difference, the pattern EIG is preserved in stray-matched, age-matched, sex-matched, genetically-matched mice otherwise. In the standard EVA2J mice, it declines massively. In our wild-as-treated mice, it's essentially retained. So preserving the axon is also preserving cell bodies and, more importantly, preserving their functions, which again focuses now on thinking of treatments directed at axons, and we're doing a lot more work in this area. In thinking about this pathway again, what I just showed you is you've got a focal insult occurring to axons within the optic nerve. This is likely adding stress to cell bodies. If this insult is severe enough, you get frank axon degeneration, and that would add further stress to the cell body, which will ultimately get integrated and contribute to somal degeneration. Now, I think it would be naive to say that that is the only sort of insulting glaucoma, and you only get one insulting glaucoma. We don't know. It's very reasonable to think there could also be insults at the cell body or at the synapses. So we're continuing our experiments, and indeed we've got evidence that there is more than one insult. I'll try to very quickly go through this story. We're now thinking about the retina itself, not the optic nerve, but the retina where the ganglion cell bodies are. We've been doing some discovery experiments, as Lee Hood terms them, and the aim of these experiments is to try to identify early molecular changes that occur prior to any visibly detectable damage. We did this for the optic nerve and the retina. I'm just going to talk about the retina. We dissected out individual optic nerve heads and individual retinas. We could stage the stage of disease and then do gene expression profiling and other subsequent tests. And we spanned all stages of disease. We could take our age-matched, sex-matched, strain-matched control, which is a no-glaucoma anchor. Morphologically, by grading the optic nerves, you could put mice into two bins, moderate and severe glaucoma. We then had our large, no-early group, I told you, I believe, to set the genius, And so we used over double the number of eyes in this group, hoping we could put them into related bins and subdivide this group based on their patterns of gene expression changes. This actually worked very, very well, and we've now identified 5 early groups of glaucoma in the optic nerve that precede morphological changes, and in the retina, 2. So the retina looks like this. You can subdivide this group now into 2 early stages, being more distant from the control or closer to the control. So what happens in these early stages in the retina? Well, this is yet another surprise. Among some of the early molecular changes in that very earliest group, 2 of these changes were complement pathway genes. Complement, a classic pathway of the innate immune system. Complement molecules are tagged onto cells and lead to partial phagocytosis of cells or complete lysis and destruction of cells. Why was the complement system coming up so early in this disease? I'd have thought this would be a player, but later on in secondary disease. Because it came up so early and in the next stage with many more of these pathways up, we decided to pay attention to it as possibly a primary propagative mechanism and not just a secondary response. Well, it turns out from a lot of work, and in collaboration with Ben Barr's work, we've got a lot of respect for, what we've been able to do is find that complement not only comes on in retinal ganglion cells in the retina, this is not in immune cells which surprise us, it's in the retinal ganglion cells themselves, and it becomes localized to synapses. So here you see our control mouse, the green is a complement antibody, the blue are nuclei. In the control mouse, there's not a lot of complement in these retinas. As you get glaucoma in the DBA2 gene mouse, you get lots of complement, and look, it's localizing into this inner plexiform layer, which is where the synapses of these cells are. This actually occurs very early in the disease. Early here, there's no morphological damage in these eyes, but if we took an eye with no morphological damage and we stain it, in some of these eyes, a subset of them, you find early complement staining. If you then look at synapses, I told you this is localizing to synapses. This is a marker for synapses. Early in the disease, this complement is localizing into synapses. This is a new high-resolution method of microscopy known as array tomography. It's at a nanometer scale in this axis, and you can very clearly see, we did this with Steve Smith at Stanford, here's an individual synapse on the postsynaptic side, you've got PSD, and then you've got complement 1 right next to it, and some of them overlap a little bit. So this is absolutely occurring in the retinal ganglion cell synapses. As the disease progresses from early to moderate, you actually see focal loss of these synapses. Now, we haven't yet completely functionally tested the role of the complement in this glaucoma, but this data suggested it might have a very early role in causing the demise of synapses in the retina. If you lose synapses in the retina, you're going to lose electrical activity and conductivity across these cells. And it's well demonstrated if you reduce neuronal activity, you make it much more susceptible to other stresses. So we believe this is one of the stresses occurring to make these ganglion cells more susceptible to overall damage. We've now bred a C1q mutation into this genetic background. Some data I got on the plane yesterday is suggesting this mutation is having a profound effect in at least temporally delaying the onset of disease, and we don't know if it's yet going to stop it or not, but we'll learn that over the next year. So this is looking like a very exciting new avenue. To summarize this part of the talk, we think high droplet pressure is somehow directly affecting cells in the retina, affecting retinal ganglion cells and astrocytes actually, resulting in C1q being tagged onto synapses, resulting in synapse loss, another stress which gets integrated and determines the fate of the cell body. I'll summarize everything I tried to show you. We started with a linear phenotype. Now we know of 2 genes which interact to perturb melanosomal biology, which damage iris cells in a very subtle way, does not cause an outward disease. The mutation in this gene also perturbs innate immunity, so that the innate immune system hyperreacts to this melanosomal damage and propagates the iris disease. The pigment and debris from this iris disease then gets into the drain of the eye, and if you're a genetically susceptible strain or individual, that will then induce a damaging reaction which damages the drain, leading to high intraocular pressure. In human pigmentary glaucoma, many individuals who get this dispersed pigment go on to get high IOP in glaucoma, many do not. So as we learn more about this, it might give us an intervention which is relevant to people. As we go on, I'll go to the retina first. From Ben's work in retinal development, he has shown that stresses can actually induce astrocytes to release a soluble factor, which then interacts with the retinal ganglion cells and causes C1q to be expressed and causes it to tag synapses. We haven't proven that in the glaucoma yet, thus it's in white, not yellow arrows, but that could be a mechanism of action leading to synapse loss and further retinal ganglion cell stress. I'd also told you we identified a focal insult to these axons, which we don't understand, but it does not require extracellular matrix plates of the lamina fibrosa, and we suspect pressure is somehow changing astrocytes and astroglial interactions in this part of the eye and contributing this disease. So we're very interested in this glial lamina and the role of the astrocytes. We've got a lot of ongoing work in all of these areas and in other models. We're actually doing genetics now. I told you we'd read these mutations in the different strains and they respond in different ways. By doing genetic and genomic studies across strains, we've uncovered all of these other loci now which are participating in different points of the disease. There's also one in chromosome 9 I don't show here. Four of these we've now confirmed by genetic analyses, and one of them last Friday we identified the gene for, so we're excited by that. In addition to implicating all these other loci we now have years to study, we've identified some neuroprotective therapies. And what I'm very excited by is many of the pathways we've been able to add into the system or other groups who now use these models we've developed actually suggest reasonable targets to test in the human condition, and many of which are druggable. So thank you very much for your time. I'd like to briefly thank past and former lab members. I'd also like to thank the various summer students we've had over the years. We're lucky to live in Bar Harbor, Maine. If anyone wants to visit, it's a wonderful place, and we actually talk a lot of science at the local cliffs where we go climbing and other things, or when we go hiking. I'd like to thank various collaborators, former postdocs who are now doing well at other institutions, and lab members. And a big thank you to all of you and my teachers and mentors here, and for this wonderful program which I went through, which I know my career would not have gone where it was without you all. And I think it's had a big impact in how it's leading on to all the future generations. So please keep it all up as you go into the future and keep on with the teaching efforts as well as the research. Thank you.
I have two questions. One is, does the biology hold true in other type of pressure type of neuropathies? Do you see something similar? And the second question is there any evidence that hypoxia plays a role in the retinal deterioration in your model?
Yes. In other pressure-induced diseases, partially depends on if you get a blunt optic nerve trauma or blunt head trauma. I think there are going to be some similarities, but possibly also many differences. We're very curious about hydrocephalus, and some of the genes we've identified in mice have also now been shown to cause human glaucoma are also associated with hydrocephalus in mice. And we're wondering about commonalities there, maybe mechanisms of intraocular pressure elevation and possibly mechanisms of the neurodegeneration. The field is yet to develop and flourish in terms of understanding those conditions, and so I can't give you a more detailed answer. In terms of hypoxia, ischemia, and these types of factors, there's a lot of debatable evidence for it. There's some very good evidence, some completely contradictory evidence in the glaucomas. My instincts are, and we're actually trying to follow some of these things up, is that hypoxia is possibly very important. I personally believe that people with glaucoma may be very susceptible to transient ischemic events and reperfusion directly in this lamina region where there's a very tenuous blood supply to the optic nerve. And so those are things for the future. There is evidence for it. There's evidence against it. I think that underlies the heterogeneity and the complexity again.
Side effect of corticosteroids is to induce glaucoma, and they are pro-apoptotic for some of the things. Is there any link with this part?
Yeah, we could talk for hours and days on all of those topics. BAD, BIM, BAC, BIF, lots of them. but probably different ones are important. We haven't gained good evidence for BUD being very important, but we've never done the functional tests. And when you're looking at such a complex disease, unless you're going to change a gene, you can never be certain. So we haven't uncovered strong evidence for it. We've got some evidence for BIM. Regarding BCL2, we did one experiment to suggest that BCL2 does not protect. So it might be getting down to the complex regulation. We could talk about, again, with the BH3-only family members and how different molecules interact with that. Or it could be there's something about our experiment that we don't understand which caused it to fail. So BCL2, we don't have a lot of evidence for. There are other members of these pathways, however, which the former postdoc Rick Libby is now working on, and he's getting quite exciting data related to BCL2 family members. I don't want to talk about his data today. I don't think it's appropriate, but if you got in touch with Rick, he might be able to tell you. Your other question, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on it, are the steroid-induced glaucoma. So in steroid-induced glaucomas, yes, steroids can be pro-apoptotic. They can actually be pro-survival. These things can be very, very complex, depending on doses, physiologic status, and many other things. So I don't really know how the steroids play out directly in the optic nerve, and that may vary from individual on what the major insults and mechanisms are active in that individual versus any other individual. In most cases of steroid glaucomas, I'm sure you're aware, it's a steroid response of the drainage structures, which causes often very, very high intraocular pressures. These pressures can sometimes reach 60, 70 millimeters of mercury, and the disease can progress very, very rapidly within days, some of which could easily be apoptosis, but I wonder if some of those pressures are so high you might even get some necrosis.
Okay, thank you again. Okay, we're going to take a break now for 15 minutes, coffee and snacks up at the top level, so please be back here at 3:15.